Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Galsky from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and today I'm going to be speaking about the role of HER2 in urothelial cancer. So HER2 has a little bit of a checkered past in urothelial cancer. We know that the target is present, and I'm going to talk about that in some more detail, but therapeutic modulation of this target has been challenging. There have been multiple studies with single-agent HER2 kinase inhibitors, which have shown little activity over the past few decades. There was a program with an adjuvant cellular therapy called lapalusil-T, basically the cipalusil-T of urothelial cancer directed against HER2, and that was studied in the adjuvant setting and did not show a clinical benefit. In naked antibodies, trastuzumab have not shown a clinical benefit. So the target's there, not a lot of clinical activity. And of course, the question is, why is that? Regarding the target, we have a lot of variability in the literature regarding HER2 expression at the protein level. And I'm going to speak a little bit about why that might be. But if we look at one of the largest data sets that used central pathology review, so this is from the adjuvant study that I just mentioned with lapalusil-T, the expression of HER2 was required to be enrolled on that study. And interestingly, we have data both from the primary cystectomy specimen and from the nodes in patients with nodal involvement. And what you can see here is that HER2 is expressed at least the 1+ level in a large subset of patients with urothelial cancer. There does seem to be a higher level of expression in metastatic sites versus the primary tumor, although the numbers are admittedly small here. And you can see if you look at the 2 to 3+ level, approximately 40 to 50% of patients have HER2 overexpression based on this analysis. We know that HER2 alterations at the genomic level are pretty common in urothelial cancer as well. And in fact, HER2 mutations might be more common in urothelial cancer than any other solid tumor. That's also been challenging, though, to target from a therapeutic standpoint. Probably one of the most interesting analyses that assessed this was from a study that was published in Nature, a basket study with neratinib, published by David Hyman several years ago. And this study enrolled patients with HER mutations across different tumor types and actually showed that the same extracellular domain mutations were present in urothelial cancer compared to some other cancer types, but there was clinical activity of that HER2 kinase inhibitor in other tumor types, but not in urothelial cancer. And perhaps that's because of the co-mutations that are present in urothelial cancer. So the mutations are present. They don't seem to confer sensitivity to kinase inhibition, but because we're doing so much next-generation sequencing and probably not a whole lot of HER2 immunohistochemical testing in urothelial cancer, the question comes up, are HER2 mutations associated with overexpression at the protein level or amplifications? And so this analysis was presented by David Agin at ASCO GU just this past year and looked at the MSKCC, the Memorial Sloan Kettering impact cohort. So patients assessed by next-generation sequencing with urothelial cancer, a fairly large cohort for patients with this disease. And what you can see in the figure is that there does seem to be an enrichment of HER2 3+ protein expression in patients with amplifications or with HER2 mutations. So certainly if you get your next-generation sequencing report and it shows one of these mutations, you might want to think about protein testing.
So can you again bring in the issue of amplification? Because, you know, in breast cancer, they do FISH in patients who are 1 or 2+. And if they're FISH positive, they're considered HER2 positive. But in this situation, the data you just showed with IHC, was that backed up with FISH also?
So the data with IHC alone was not backed up with FISH. Some of the more contemporary data sets are using both FISH and immunohistochemistry, similar to what's done in breast cancer.
And the other question is, I hadn't heard about HER2 mutations in urothelial bladder cancer. And of course, that's a big issue in lung cancer, where basically they're using T-DXd first line, mainly for these mutation patients. How do the mutations in lung cancer compare to the ones seen here with urothelial bladder?
So the probably the most common mutations in bladder cancer are in the extracellular domain. There's a lot more mutations in the kinase domain and other solid tumors. And we're going to take a look at a very small data set that's assessed the relationship between mutations and response to T-DXd.
Incidentally, you know, I find, you know, this idea of, you know, HER2 less, you know, one or two plus, but FISH positive, I don't really hear that exactly when I get outside of breast cancer. Is that the way you look at it?
So in terms of HER2 one plus?
One or two plus, that, you yes. know, one or two plus is HER2 positive if the FISH is greater than two. Is that the way you look at it?
So we're looking at it slightly differently based on the correlations between expression and outcomes with anti-HER2 ADCs. And most of the focus now is on the protein expression. And I'll show some of that data. But to summarize, what we tend to see is that 2 plus FISH positive or 3 plus do the best in terms of correlation with response to HER2 ADCs.
And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but do you see responses to T-DXd with the HER2 mutations that you see in urethral bladder?
So I'll show you some of that data, and the data, the cohort is very small. You do see some responses. The cohort is small. It's a complicated signal, and I'll tell you why.
Great.
So one of the challenges with quantifying HER2 expression in urothelial cancer and why the estimates in the literature are all over the board is one, because different antibody clones are being used in different reports, retrospective studies, not necessarily consistent antibodies and scoring approaches. But the other is that the expression pattern seems to be different in urothelial cancer than some other solid tumors. We know that there's a difference in gastric cancer and breast cancer in terms of the pattern of expression. Gastric cancer a little bit more U-shaped and patchy, breast cancer more circular and homogeneous. And bladder cancer seems to maybe be a little bit of a mix of the two. So that you see circular, you see membranous expression, but you also see patchy expression. And that might not only have implications in terms of testing, but it actually has implications in terms of drug development as well. Of course, because when you have patchy expression of a target and you're using an antibody drug conjugate, it's probably important that you have a cleavable linker. And we know that if you don't have a cleavable linker, then you might not get as much bystander effect. That is that once the antibody drug conjugate reaches a drug with expression of the antigen, is that payload cleaved off and does it have the potential to impact cells in the neighborhood? So most of the drugs being developed right now do have cleavable linkers. Of note, T-DM1 doesn't have a cleavable linker. Here's a list of HER2 ADCs that have been explored in urothelial cancer, at least with some clinical data to date. You'll see that the antibodies are mostly trastuzumab, but not exclusively in disitamab, which I'll talk about more, is actually a unique antibody directed against a different epitope on HER2. And then you see the payloads are across the board a little bit, either maytansinoids or topoisomerase inhibitors. So why is the linker important? This is what I was just getting at. And I think this is one of the most elegant examples or explanations for this. So in this study, they took two different HER2-expressing breast cancer cell lines, a HER2-expressing breast cancer cell line and a HER2 non-expressing cell line, mixed them together, established xenografts, and then treated with a drug with a cleavable linker versus a non-cleavable linker. And you see that with T-DM1 in this model, you eradicate the HER2 positive cells, but not the HER2 negative cells. And with T-DXd with the cleavable linker, you eradicate both populations. So it's a model, and it's we have to acknowledge the limitations of models, but it really does reinforce this concept that with patchy expression of a target, you want a cleavable linker. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about trastuzumab deruxtecan, T-DXd, and disitamab vedotin, because those are the molecules that we have the most clinical data so far in urothelial cancer. I'm going to start with the DESTINY-PanTumor02 study. So this is trastuzumab deruxtecan explored in a basket study with multiple different cohorts, 40 patients per cohort, and we'll look at the bladder cancer cohort. In this study, patients had to have HER2 overexpression, and a gastric scoring was used, and local testing was permitted, at least initially on the study. And here's the summary of the results. So in the left part of the slide, you see the urothelial cancer cohort, and you see that in all comers, regardless of the level of HER2 expression, there was a response rate of 39%. And these are patients who have progressed despite standard treatments. And patients with IHC3+, which is a smaller subset, response rate of 56%. And then 2+, 35%. When we look at all patients in the study, so not just urothelial cancer, but the whole cohort in the table here, what you can see is that there does seem to be a relationship between the degree of overexpression of HER2 at the protein level and response rate. And we're seeing this across programs and really across different diseases. So unlike some other ADC targets where the expression level of the target hasn't correlated as well, there does seem to be a relationship here. And you see in the full cohort, response rate of 27% in HER2 2+ patients, and a response rate of 61% in patients with 3+ overexpression by IHC. Here's the PFS data, though. And with PFS, and we have to acknowledge the small numbers here. So this is just the urothelial cancer cohort. You don't see much of a difference in PFS between patients with 2+ versus 3+ expression.
Again, when you talk about 2 and 3+, we don't know the fish, right?
We don't know the fish here. I'm going to show you some data with disitamab vedotin where the fish is incorporated into the results, but here we don't know.
But I mean, you know, even if they could go back, if they could just look at the responding patients and see if the fish was low, you'd know you see responses in HER2 low, which would be amazing.
Absolutely. Great point. Here's the AE data. And with trastuzumab deruxtecan, of course, there are side effects which are related to probably both the target expression and to the payload. And so you see 12 topoisomerase related side effects, you see GI side effects, you see cytopenias, although the cytopenias aren't very severe. And then you do see pneumonitis with this molecule, and you can see the frequency of pneumonitis at the table at the bottom. So certainly one of those side effects, which is uncommon, but you have to think about every time you reach for this drug. So getting back to the issue of mutations. So this is a separate basket study called PanTumor01, and very similar in design with trastuzumab deruxtecan, but here instead of enriching for patients or selecting for patients based on HER2 expression at the protein level, here the selection was based on the presence of mutations. And you can see the pre-specified HER2 mutations, which were allowed per the inclusion criteria. And that extracellular domain mutation, that S310 mutation, that's probably the most common in urothelial cancer. The kinase domain mutations are a little bit less common, and we'll look at the data and why that might be relevant. So here's the data across the whole study. You see that mutations were associated with activity with trastuzumab deruxtecan across tumor types. In urothelial cancer, only data on 7 patients, so it's quite limited. You do see regressions there, but most of those regressions did not meet the criteria for RECIST-defined response. And you see that the patient who had the largest response was a patient with an extracellular domain mutation. So in that patient also had IHC3+ expression. And so there does seem to be activity based on the mutations, whether or not the protein expression trumps the mutations. It looks like that's possible, but obviously we need more data. And again, because we're doing more next generation sequencing probably than HER2 testing throughout the country in urothelial cancer, it's certainly possible that patients will be identified first by mutation testing. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about disitamab vedotin. Disitamab vedotin was previously known as RC48. This drug has been through development in Asia, And so it's been through phase two studies in China. So we have a decent amount of data about disitamab vedotin. This is the antibody that's directed against a different epitope on HER2 than trastuzumab. And it is conjugated to MMAE. And you can see here pooling of results from two studies, which were designed very similarly. So two separate phase two studies, similar eligibility, and this is the activity in patients with HER2 overexpression at either the 2 or 3+ level. And you can see most of these patients were pretreated. So two lines of prior treatment in 64% of patients, one line of prior treatment in about a third of the patients. And you see in the waterfall plot a pretty robust activity for second and third line therapy with a response rate of 50%. And then if you look at the table, here we start to see the breakdown of patients who have IHC 2+, FISH positive, or 3+, versus those with IHC 2+, who are FISH negative. And of course, the issue with the data here is one, it's a small sample size, and two, the IHC 2+, FISH positive, and 3+, are pooled, but you do see that there are there's a numerically higher likelihood of response in patients with either IHC 2+, FISH positive, or 3+, versus 2+, FISH negative. And you see responses really at a similar rate regardless of the lines of prior treatment and the types of prior treatment. So that was certainly encouraging data. Now, the question, of course, arises again, is there activity even in patients with lower levels of HER2 expression because of the cleavable linker? And so this is, again, very small data set, but this is the activity of disitamab vedotin in patients with IHC 0 or 1+ expression. And you see there is activity, particularly in patients with 1+ expression, with a response rate of 26% here. The adverse events of these drugs are different because the targets are different and the payloads are different. And I think we have a pretty nice example of this in urothelial cancer because we actually have three antibody drug conjugates here, which all share either the same target or the same payload. So you can do some cross-trial comparisons, although we have to take those with a little bit of grain of salt. And here you see that with enfortumab vedotin, which we use quite commonly in urothelial cancer, the adverse events that we get concerned about are neuropathy and rash, and a subset of patients will have hyperglycemia. With disitamab vedotin, different target, but same payload, neuropathy is still present. We see a little bit more elevation in transaminases with DV than with EV, and we don't see the rash, and we tend not to see hyperglycemia, at least based on the data that's evolved so far.
There was one question I really wanted to ask you in general. I've been really curious in general what urologic clinical researchers think about, and it kind of ties into what you were saying about efficacy of antibody drug conjugates, which is any thoughts about why we see such excellent efficacy of enfortumab plus pembro?
So
what's going on there?
So there is some hand-waving immunologic explanation for that. There's been at least one study that didn't use immune competent models, and so it's somewhat limited, but was able to show at least in the myeloid compartment that with EV you get upregulation of antigen presentation machinery. So it might be something immunologic. But the other thing that might be going on, and there's certainly been some compelling data published in solid tumors in general about additivity versus synergy, and that additivity explains probably the benefit of most of the combinations that we use. You know, as single agents, these drugs certainly work in a fair subset of patients. They have non-overlapping toxicity for the most part. And so we might just be capturing a broad population of patients by giving the two drugs at the same time.
It also gets into something that's seems really hard to figure out, at least for me, which is kind of, I think, related to duration of response. You know, a lot of people oncologists come out of breast cancer really wanting to use T-DXd because they just see it lasts a long time. And I'm not, yeah, you can see it in the numbers, but I hear it from the doctors also. And I'm kind of wondering if that's part of what's going on with this.
I think you're right. I think the tail on the curves with both of those classes of drugs. So ADCs seem to have a tail, much different than traditional cytotoxic therapy, as do immune checkpoint inhibitors, of course. And when you give the two together, that stacks up.
Yeah, I mean, that the thing to me that strikes me so graphically is that it looks like when you give an ADC plus an IO, and I know we're kind of getting far out, but it kind of gets into what you're getting at here with ADCs. Because I guess part of what I'm saying is maybe enfortumab is sort of a better ADC than I thought it was. I mean, I know it was really good, but it's hard to tell if there's anything really good and like really, really good. And I don't know how to explain that. So anyhow, I've just been sort of curious about what's going on there. Do you think it's just enfortumab itself? There's something about it in bladder that's just extremely effective?
I think it's a very effective drug. I think that the ability to give it for a relatively long period of time, barring the development of neuropathy, certainly we're able to give drugs like that longer than we have with cisplatin-based chemotherapy in the past, for instance. And there seems to be an ongoing benefit rather than sort of a plateau of benefit after six cycles.
It just seems that, you know, like, and I think about this in other cancers too, where they haven't really looked at IO plus chemo, and they have IOs, and I mean, they're starting to look at it, but it just looks like in bladder that when you combine IO and chemo, or if you do chemo and then IO maintenance, somehow it's not as effective as an ADC plus IO, or at least this ADC.
I think you're right. And I'm going to show a slide a little bit later that, that questions whether or not there is something particularly special about MMAE containing our ADCs with IO.
And one other thing just related to that, because, you know, of course, this whole issue of first line, what are you going to do in HER2 when people have EV Pembro up front? Just, you know, curious about what your thoughts were right now in terms of that strategy. It just seems so dramatic when you combine it, but maybe it's just 1 + 1 = 2, which is a really good 2, I guess.
Yeah, and I still think that might be the explanation, but regardless, the data is so impressive that I think it's really the standard first-line treatment.
For sure. Please continue.
So there are some other data sets emerging with HER2 ADCs, and this data was presented at ASCO a couple years ago now. Very similar data set. This is a different ADC directed against HER2 in metastatic urothelial cancer, similar population to those that I just showed. And again, you see activity here with a response rate of 55%. So regardless of the HER2 ADC in urothelial cancer, we're seeing pretty similar results. And it speaks to the fact that this target, which has been challenging from a signal transduction standpoint, is a bona fide target for selective delivery of cytotoxics with an ADC. So let's talk a little bit about the combinations that you mentioned. And so we do have data with combination therapy with anti-HER2 ADC plus IO with a trastuzumab deruxtecan and with disitamab vedotin. The data with trastuzumab deruxtecan actually came before the single agent data, interestingly. And so this study was conducted several years ago, trastuzumab deruxtecan plus Nevo in two diseases, in breast cancer and in urothelial cancer. This was a relatively small cohort. There was a little bit of a dose escalation phase and then a cohort expansion. So the numbers are smaller than some of the other data sets that I showed you. But what you can see here is that in patients who had previously received platinum-based therapy, the response rate in the all-comer group, this is 2+ or 3+ expression, the response rate was 36%. If you look at patients with HER2 expression at the 3+ level, the response rate was 62%. Again, very small numbers, 8 patients. So that seems to be a little bit different than what we saw with single agent therapy, or actually the numbers are lining up pretty similarly to what we saw with single agent trastuzumab deruxtecan. And whether or not that's just based on when this study was done, the level of prior treatments that patients received, the small sample size, I think that's hard to know. I don't think the full story is written here. When we look at disitamab vedotin, which is labeled here as RC48, the old name, plus toripalimab, which is an anti-PD-1 antibody. So this was done in China, and this study includes patients who either had no prior treatment, so first-line treatment in 60% of the patients, and then 39% had at least one prior line of therapy. Patients could enroll regardless of HER2 expression. So it does include some patients with HER2 zero. You can see in the green there. And you see a response rate of 71.8% in this population of patients, very similar to what we saw with some of the initial studies with EV plus Pembro. And so intriguing data here. This really raises this question. And I think this is pure speculation. Numbers are small. Some of these studies were first line. Some of them included patients who had prior treatment. But if we take that with a grain of salt, what you tend to see here is that the MMAE-containing ADCs with IO, the response rates are in the 70% range. With the topoisomerase inhibitor ADCs with IO, we're seeing more in the 30% range. And so is there something immunological going on here, or is this just noise? I think we need more data to determine that definitively, but it's some food for thought. So where is this going? So there is a large international phase 2 confirmatory study with disitamab vedotin, and this study includes three cohorts of patients. Patients with HER2 low expression, so this can be 1+ or 2+. Patients with HER2 high levels of expression, so 2+ FISH positive or 3+. And those cohorts enroll patients who have prior platinum-based chemotherapy and have progressed, but patients who have not received enfortumab vedotin. Cohort C is a combination of disitamab vedotin plus pembrolizumab, based on the compelling data from disitamab vedotin plus toripalimab. And this will include a randomized component to assess contribution of DV alone versus DV plus Pembro.
So you don't hear too much, or at least I haven't heard too much about PD-1 levels in urothelial bladder cancer, but what about HER2 positive urothelial bladder cancer? I think it's gastroesophageal where like 85% of HER2 is PD-1 positive, and they give it first line, et cetera. What about HER2 positive urothelial bladder? Any correlation with PD-1, or what do you see in PD-1 levels?
So in that study presented by David Agin that looked at the mutations and the relationship between HER2 mutations and HER2 expression that I showed earlier, he showed data for PD-L1 expression as well, and it suggested a negative correlation. So higher HER2, less PD-L1. That sort of goes along with what we know about HER2 expression at least the gene expression level being enriched in more luminal-like bladder cancers, which tend to have lower T-cell infiltration. All of that said, PD-L1 expression has not correlated that well with immune checkpoint blockade response in bladder cancer to begin with. So I think we're making those correlations with an imperfect biomarker anyway, but that is the data that was presented.
One other thing I was going to ask you earlier on in the talk, when you went through sort of the prior history of treating HER2, I think it was a basket trial where they looked at trastuzumab, pertuzumab, where they actually saw pretty good response rates. Was that bladder?
Yes, you're absolutely right. So that was bladder, and that was actually one of the first studies that showed that with naked antibodies, that there was actually some activity. And so there is a basket study with trastuzumab plus tucatinib that has not been presented yet that I think will follow up on a similar concept.
Right, the Mountaineer strategy that they're using in approved in colon cancer right now. Yeah, that's really interesting. All right, please continue.
So I was going to present a couple cases. And the first patient is a 78-year-old man who has a long history of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, develops lung nodules on imaging, and undergoes a biopsy, which confirms metastatic disease. It's not something that we see so commonly that someone goes straight from non-muscle invasive disease to metastatic disease, but we definitely see this once in a while. And so he gets standard treatment at the time, gemcitabine plus cisplatin, has a good response, but ultimately develops progressive disease, has his tumor stain for HER2, and it's 2+ by IHC. So he initiates treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan and actually has a really good response to treatment, receives 16 doses, but then starts to develop progressive dyspnea. And so we do this scan and it shows this. And of course, what we see here are ground glass opacities. And so he's developed symptomatic pneumonitis. And in patients who develop symptomatic pneumonitis with trastuzumab deruxtecan, of course, we stop treatment and don't resume. And treat with steroids. And so he was treated with steroids. This resolved, and he had a prolonged response even after stopping trastuzumab deruxtecan. So it speaks to the potential side effects, but also speaks to the potential durability of responses with ADCs even after you stop them sometimes.
So what happened subsequently with the patient?
So he ultimately did develop progressive disease, but this was a response that lasted about a year and a half.
A year and a half without treatment.
Without treatment.
Yeah.
Without treatment.
Cases like that, yep. And the oncologists see that in breast cancer, and they want to use it wherever they can. Going back to this case, a couple other points. Well, first of all, what about ADC? After ADC, if this patient were progressing right now, would you think about dasatamab if you could access it?
So it's a great question. And so we have two ADCs that are approved in urothelial cancer, and then there's disitamab vedotin. So some interesting questions come up, which have biological considerations and clinical considerations. So do we go to another anti-HER2 ADC in a patient who's progressed on an anti-HER2 ADC? Do we go to a different ADC with the same payload but a different target, or do we switch it up completely? And I think all of those are options, and we don't know the right answer. And it really depends on the mechanism of resistance, which we don't understand quite well.
I guess another thought would be, and you know, maybe you can talk about your algorithm, which is the potential for rechallenge with TDXD. And of course, he was symptomatic. So, according to at least particularly the way breast cancer people approach it, any symptoms, they're not getting it again. Although sometimes if they respond rapidly to steroids and, a lot of other clinical things, it might be a consideration. Just to verify though, is that your approach? Any symptoms? That's it?
That's right. Particularly when we have other options available.
Right. But also, I'm sure this patient was treated, a while back, and I'm not sure exactly. I'm curious to know. I want to ask you right now, this is another thing where it's like you get a lot of different answers once you get outside of breast cancer in terms of screening for ILD. So I don't know what you did in this man, but what were you doing and what would you do or what are you doing right now today in terms of again, let's say you don't need to get scans of the chest. There's no disease in the chest. Are you going to go ahead and get regular scans, and assuming the patient is asymptomatic, looking for it? Are you going to look for clinical symptoms, give them a pulse oximeter, et cetera? Today, how would you approach screening with TDXD?
So in urothelial cancer, we tend to do chest imaging along with abdominal pelvic imaging routinely on restaging. Whether or not that's the right or wrong thing to do, that's pretty typical to get a CAT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. So we do pretty frequent chest scanning in patients receiving this drug. I have not done sort of prophylactic pulse ox monitoring, although an interesting consideration.
Yeah, I don't hear too many breast people doing, clinical stuff, but they're very aggressive about pulmonary. I mean, if they can, they'll get it every 8 weeks. They get it as often as the insurance will allow them. And the other question is how long you do that for, which is another issue. Another thing that's interesting once you get outside breast cancer is to hear about how people approach acute, prevention and management of GI toxicity. Because, initially people thought about ADCs, less toxicity, but at least TDXD sort of got the reputation of being mitogenic, and at least in breast, they're pretty aggressive. What about you? How do you approach that?
Yeah, we're similarly pretty aggressive about it. But I find that the I find that the GI side effects are really heterogeneous, more so than I think my experience with traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy.
So just going back to other couple aspects of the case that were interesting, and one in particular was the fact that he, as you mentioned, he went from non-muscle invasive to metastatic disease. I don't know if you were taking care of him in that time. Was it like lack of follow-up or very aggressive disease?
I think aggressive disease had certainly adequate follow-up and was under regular cystoscopic surveillance. And I think what happens potentially in some of these patients is that they have submucosal disease that's not appreciated on cystoscopy and ultimately leads to metastatic disease.
How often do you see that, though? I mean, I would assume it's very uncommon.
It's very uncommon. It's very uncommon.
And he'd gotten, what, intravesicular therapy for the non-muscle invasive disease?
Yep. Standard treatment, initial BCG, and then subsequently intravesical chemotherapy.
And then again, you're right up. You've got IHC 2 plus by IHC, no mention of fish. Nowadays, do you normally get fish?
So we're starting to do HER2 testing uniformly in our patients with urothelial cancer. Our pathologists are starting to do it routinely on cystectomy specimens. That's not done uniformly in this disease, and I think there are some considerations in terms of resource utilization and how that information does help. I think that could change, of course, dramatically with the first approval of an anti-HER2 ADC in urothelial cancer. But for now, we do it routinely, and our pathologist reflects to fish with 2+ expression.
All right, let's go to your next case.
So the next case is a 69-year-old man. He has upper tract urothelial cancer, so he undergoes a nephrouretectomy for T3 disease. He develops metastatic disease to the retroperitoneal nodes, and then he's treated on a clinical trial with gemcitabine cisplatin plus PD-L1 plus CTLA-4 blockade. So a quadruple combination regimen. Has a very good response and proceeds with maintenance durvalumab as per the trial, but ultimately develops progressive disease, and he also has 2+ expression by IHC, and so he initiates treatment with disitamab vedotin. And here you can see his retroperitoneal nodes. There's a close-up of his retroperitoneal nodes, two in particular, and you can see over time the red X's marking these nodes shrinking over time. And at about 12 months, very minimal evidence of disease, and he has progressive neuropathy. And so he stops treatment because of neuropathy, not because of evidence of progression, and is maintained off of the ADC now for about a year with no evidence of progression, off all treatment. Obviously a outlier, but certainly something that we are seeing in a subset of patients.
What about it, from your point of view, is the outlying part of it?
That this durability of response off of treatment is certainly not the most common pattern, but it is a potential pattern.
I guess one of the other issues is, as you were describing it, I was thinking to myself, how this compares to what you hear about brentuximab vedotin in terms of lymphomas, you know, Hodgkin, et cetera, usually reversible, mainly sensory. Does that line up with the type of neuropathy this is?
I think we see a little bit more motor neuropathy with EV than with BV, although that might just be how it's being assessed I don't know that we have hard data on that, but that's my impression. With DV, the pattern of neuropathy seems to be pretty similar to EV, although it might be a little bit hand waving, but maybe it's occurring a little bit later. But we don't have enough data to know that for sure.
So I assume there's no major dermatologic issues
with
disitamab?
So we see a little bit of rash with disitamab in some patients, but certainly not the frequency of rash and not the severity of rash that we see with EV. And of course, the explanation with EV is that there's nectin expression in the skin. I think the fact that we see some rash with DV suggests that it's probably more complicated than just nectin expression in the skin, but we aren't seeing those severe rashes to date that can be seen with EV.
And speaking of that, as you know, again, we're you know, it's such an incredible story, enfortumab and Pembro, and I think it relates to HER2 also, because the next thing I was going to ask you is, like, how does changing first-line therapy, if at all, affect HER2? Are there trials looking at first-line? Any thoughts about the key challenges they're going to face on community-based oncologists? I mean, I'm sure you use a certain amount of enfortumab, but probably a lot less than you think, incidentally. But in terms of, you know, this regimen and in the first line, what do you think the major challenges are going to be? I brought up skin because I kind of was thinking that's going to be the biggest issue, but you tell me.
So I think with EV Pembro, the skin toxicity and knowing when it is serious versus not, and knowing when to intervene is key. I think the neuropathy takes some experience in terms of knowing when to hold doses and when to reduce doses. And it needs to be recognized early because it can change fairly quickly in terms of impact on function. So those are the two big ones. And then, of course, making sure that one, it takes a look at glucose on day of treatment to make sure that a patient isn't one of those rare patients that's developing hyperglycemia, which could turn into something much more serious.
Any issues where maybe there might be some confusion in terms of what's causing the problem? I mean, for example, you can get diabetes from IOs. You can get dermatologic problems from IOs. Like, clinically, is there an easy way to determine what's it coming from?
There's not. It's quite challenging. I mean, there are some patterns of skin toxicity and some biopsy findings that might point one way or another. But I think for the side effects that do overlap, it can be quite complicated. And most of the algorithms for toxicities that are overlapping suggest holding both, treating when it improves, reintroducing one drug at a time. And that tends to be my strategy.
Just some thoughts about where things are heading, first of all, in terms of first-line therapy and metastatic disease with HER2 positive. Again, gastroesophageal, we saw anti-HER therapy coming in 10 years ago. Now they've got IO on top of that. What are some of the key trials in the first-line setting? It's kind of hard for me to sort of figure out how you would integrate an anti-HER2 IO into first-line therapy. Is that going to be looked at?
So there's a large phase 3 study that's been launched exploring DV Pembro versus platinum-based chemotherapy. Of course, the clear challenge to doing that study is the changing landscape in this disease. That said, not everywhere in the world has access, unfortunately, to EV Pembro. And so there is the possibility to still do that study. And I think that particularly in patients with HER2/3+ expression and maybe 2+ with FISH positivity, like you were commenting on, based on the small numbers of patients in the data sets that we have available so far, if you look at DV plus toripalimab, or the DV alone experience, the response rates in those subsets of patients are really, really quite high. And so I do think that there is the possibility to carve out a HER2-based regimen in patients with HER2 expression at the highest levels. But of course, we'll need the phase 3 data to do that, and we'll need to be able to complete the phase 3 study before the landscape changes completely to be able to know the answer to that.
Well, I guess also, you know, if you think at a simplistic level, you have EV Pembro extremely effective. If you could layer something on top of that was anti-HER, like an ADC, but I don't know that you could combine it, maybe maintenance. I mean, how would you think about if you wanted to somehow get in EV Pembro, but also an anti-HER2 ADC, for example?
So we do have, as you probably know, I think the first combination ADC results in urothelial cancer in a phase one study that combined enfortumab vedotin and sacituzumab govotecan, what's known as the DAD trial, now published in Annals of Oncology. And so we know that that regimen in patients who are heavily pretreated shows a high level of activity, and those drugs could be given together. And so I think that really sets the stage for ADC combinations. We'll have to be thoughtful about those combinations. Using two ADCs with the same payload, with the same side effect profile or overlapping side effects may be challenging. So I think the concept of enfortumab plus disitamab is actually quite interesting in potentially targeting different populations of cells, but I think whether or not the toxicity profile with the payload being the same would be acceptable, that remains to be seen. But I think your idea about switching in terms of the ADC maintenance strategy is quite interesting as well, because even though these drugs can be given for a decent amount of time, there are treatment-related toxicities with some of these, and one could imagine switching to a different ADC with a different side effect profile if one was stopping because of toxicity and not because of progression.
And of course, again, not to keep bringing up breast cancer, but, you know, breast cancer evolved into a model where almost everybody gets neoadjuvant therapy that includes anti-HER therapy at this point, mainly antibodies. But, and, you know, obviously neoadjuvant is a key strategy in bladder. I know EV Pembro is being looked at neoadjuvant. I'm curious, incidentally, what you think about that. But what about neoadjuvant, you know, therapy, including anti-HER strategies?
So I think it certainly warrants exploration based on the activity that we're seeing with anti-HER2 ADCs. And in the benefit of that approach, maybe compared to lots of the other neoadjuvant approaches that are based on the expression of a target, of course, is that this is immunohistochemistry. And I think a lot of the things that we'd like to do in the neoadjuvant setting have been complicated because of the turnaround time for the biomarker. But this is something that at least that hurdle could be overcome.
I mean, every day in breast cancer, so I'm sure it can be done. Yes. Also, you know, again, sort of thinking about where things might be headed in terms of, you know, bringing HER2 strategies in earlier. Any other kinds of strategies that you think or are being looked at in clinical trials in earlier stage disease? And I mean, I would ask you this in general in terms of neoadjuvant with bladder. Again, I'm curious what you think about EV Pembro. Do you think we're going to be moving into a stage where maybe with more effective therapy, we can be doing less cystectomies?
I do. So I think, you know, the data with EV Pembro in the metastatic setting, of course, is so compelling that the trials in the neoadjuvant setting, we're anxiously awaiting those results. There are two such trials. One is KEYNOTE 905, which is comparing EV Pembro followed by cystectomy versus cystectomy alone. So in a cisplatin ineligible patient population for whom we've had no neoadjuvant treatment options. And then KEYNOTE B15 is comparing neoadjuvant EV Pembro to GemCis. I think both of those studies are probably among the most important phase three studies ongoing in bladder cancer right now. We know that EV alone has a path CR rate based on very preliminary data in about the 30% range. We know that Pembro has a complete pathologic response rate of about 30% based on studies so far. If we're really seeing some additivity in the neoadjuvant setting, similar to what we see in the metastatic setting, then one can imagine path CR rates that surpass what we've seen in the past. And if you do see that, then that opens the door for strategies that that one can avoid cystectomy.
So in the editorial for the EV Pembro paper in the New England Journal, they brought up the issue of what's going to be second line. So I would ask you, how are you thinking through second line in a patient that gets EV Pembro? But in even more relevant, how are you thinking through second line in a patient that gets EV Pembro but is HER2 positive?
So in patients who are regardless of HER2 expression or patients who don't have HER2 overexpression, we we need to accumulate more data with platinum-based chemotherapy after EV pembro to, one, know if it's feasible to administer in the context of prior neuropathy and other potential side effects, and two, whether or not it's as still an active regimen. And in I'm referring in particular to cisplatin-based chemotherapy. We know that cisplatin-based chemotherapy in urothelial cancer has dramatic effects in a small subset of patients, and whether or not that effect still exists after someone's progressed on EV pembro, we don't know for sure, but it would be a shame to get rid of that entirely and just move on to new drugs when we haven't evaluated that sufficiently.
Just before you go on, just curious, in the new age of NGS and HR deficiency, et cetera, any correlations or what would you expect to see in terms of correlations with HR deficiency and benefit from platinum?
So probably the best, the most consistent correlation has been with alterations in the nucleotide excision repair gene, ERCC2.
Right, right.
That's a pretty solid association. Some of the others, which are a bit softer because the mutations can occur in various locations in the gene and we don't know the functional implications, I think that that story is not as clean.
So you commented on the lack of evidence with platinum chemotherapy after EV pembro. Like, what are you doing for practical purposes outside of trials?
So we're starting to do that. We're starting to give GemCis or GemCarbo after EV pembro. The number of patients who have required that, fortunately, has not been a huge sample size so far based on the timing of when EV pembro has been more widespread available. But I think we'll generate that data. The other strategy that's commonly used is to move to sacituzumab govotecan next. And certainly there are many people who will go to sacituzumab govotecan immediately after EV pembro.
I assume that'd be a lot better tolerated as well.
Yeah. And I think that's probably right. And if we're really not seeing that subset of patients who achieve really durable responses with cisplatin-based chemotherapy in the second-line setting, and it's difficult to administer after prior MMAE, then I think that strategy will probably be short-lived.
So speaking of sacituzumab, I know that's not the main topic here, but as long as we brought it up, I just wanted to pick your brain about what, because we're, again, thinking of doing some type of education program on, you know, utilizing sacituzumab. And I'm just kind of curious, and, you know, obviously the drug's been out there a while, people have a lot of experience with it. But, you know, we're even talking about at the nursing level, et cetera. From a granular point of view, from your point of view, when you use sacituzumab in metastatic urothelial bladder cancer, what are sort of the day-to-day issues? Is mainly about GI issues and cytopenias, or what are some of the sort of day-to-day issues that are mainly involved?
It is really GI toxicity and cytopenias. I tend to use growth factors pretty routinely, prophylactically. And so I know that there are some different practices in that regard, but I find that the cytopenias are common enough and unpredictable enough that I tend to do that. And the GI toxicities are certainly there, but usually manageable with the routine management strategies that we employ with diarrhea for topoisomerase inhibitors.
If a patient on sacituzumab ends up in the hospital because of a complication of treatment, what's it likely to be from?
Cytopenias, febrile neutropenia. Huh.
Right. Let's go to your last slide. But before you talk about that, can you comment again, getting back to second line therapy, EV pembro first line? Assume you could access dasatinib, for example. How would you think through second line therapy in a HER2 plus patient? And would it matter if the patient were very symptomatic? Would it matter if the patient had a prior history of lung disease? How would you think it through?
So a patient who progresses on EV pembro who has HER2 overexpression, and I have DV and I have trastuzumab deruxtecan, think that's a really challenging decision, and I would probably try trastuzumab deruxtecan because of the different payload in that setting. But I think we need the data to know if there is cross resistance between DV and EV. We absolutely need that data. There will be a small cohort generated as part of one of the studies that's ongoing to determine whether or not those drugs are cross resistant.
I didn't hear you say platinum or some other alternative. So you would be thinking about an ADC.
I would. So if the target is there, then I would use an anti-HER2 strategy.
Theoretically, any preference? You know, obviously you have similar choices in breast cancer, actually, where you have sacituzumab available, for example. But any thoughts about, you know, sort of a decision-making in that situation? You know, one of the things I hear in breast cancer, for example, like if the patient is symptomatic and they really need a response, they may be more, like in breast, they might be more likely to go with T-DXd. If they're asymptomatic, don't have visceral disease, maybe they're older, they might go with something not T-DXd.
Right. I think that for most patients in that situation in urothelial cancer, of course, there's heterogeneity in the disease. But for most patients who have progressed despite first-line therapy in urothelial cancer, it's an aggressive disease. And so certainly for someone with HER2-3 plus expression, based on, again, small numbers, but if you look at the response rate to trastuzumab deruxtecan 3 plus expression versus sacituzumab govitecan in all comers, it seems to be higher in patients with the anti-HER2 strategy. Of course, that's with that would require the availability of these therapies. But if they were both available, then that would be my thinking.
So let's go to your last summary slide. But one more EV Pembro question I just have to ask you, which is duration of each.
So the EV part can be a little bit more straightforward in that usually toxicity dictates when you stop EV. And for most patients for whom we stop EV because of toxicity, it's because of neuropathy. And that could be variable from one patient to another in terms of when that happens. But if you're going to stop treatment for a toxicity, it's probably going to be for neuropathy. The Pembro part, of course, is much more challenging because patients on Pembro for 2 years with no side effects and a great response to treatment, in my personal experience, I find that most patients are very hesitant to stop. There are a small subset of patients who can't wait to stop, and certainly I think it's reasonable to do that in such patients, but I find that more commonly it's a patient does not want to stop, quite reasonably so in that setting.
So just kind of curious in your own practice, also looking at the data in general, how long do people end up being on enfortumab in this for a first line situation, sort of the minimum and maximum?
Yeah, so probably about 6 to 8 cycles is pretty common. In terms of maximum, we have patients on for a year. And that happens not uncommonly.
So, of course, as in every solid tumor program, at some point somebody's going to bring up cell-free DNA. This might be a good time to do it, particularly as you were talking about whether to stop therapy or not. Obviously, we saw some really cool data in the adjuvant setting. What about cell-free DNA for this question in general, urothelial bladder cancer?
So for this specific question, there have been a few clinical trials proposed, including one through the NCTN, through the NCI cooperative groups, to try and ask that very question. So we have no data, but it's a great question in terms of whether or not that's a tool that we can use to determine duration of treatment. In terms of other disease settings, so yes, incredibly important topic in urothelial cancer right now. There are two large adjuvant studies that have been launched to try and determine the clinical utility of ctDNA testing in guiding adjuvant treatment decisions. One of them is IMvigor 11, which is enrolling patients after cystectomy, and patients who have detectable ctDNA are randomized to adjuvant atezolizumab versus placebo. The other study was launched in January through the Alliance, an NCTN study available throughout the United States, and that's called the Modern Study. In Modern, enrolls patients post-cystectomy who have ctDNA testing, and if ctDNA is detectable, patients are randomized to standard adjuvant nivolumab versus the combination of nivolumab plus the LAG-3 inhibitor relatlimab. If patients have undetectable ctDNA, then they're randomized to standard adjuvant therapy with nivolumab versus surveillance. And that group has serial ctDNA, and if they have conversion from negative to positive, then they're able to start nivolumab at that point.
What about upper tract lesions?
So upper tract, so upper tract patients are not being enrolled in Modern, and that was because in subset analyses of the prior studies, there seems to be a questionable signal. I would say that that's probably overinterpreting that subset analysis data, but that was the decision that was made for Modern. I do think ctDNA has potential transformative impact on upper tract disease because of our difficulty with staging upper tract disease, but that's a separate topic.
These two trials that you're talking about, are they using the Signatera assay?
Both of them are using Signatera.
Are there other bespoke assays out there like Signatera, incidentally?
So there's an assay that uses a slightly different approach that for which there's data, there's published data in urothelial cancer. And this is an assay that instead of doing tumor whole exome and picking mutations to design a bespoke PCR-based assay for the plasma, instead of doing that, the assay involves whole genome of the tumor and whole genome of the blood, and using bioinformatics to try and see what's common between the tumor and the blood. Of course, the potential benefit of that strategy is that one does not have to wait to test the blood based on designing a bespoke assay for the blood based on the tumor. One can sequence both the blood and the tumor at the same time. And so there is some intriguing data with that approach, and there will be more data in urothelial cancer.
I would have to say, it seems like it'd be awfully tempting to utilize cell-free DNA right now in the adjuvant setting outside of a trial. Do you ever find yourself tempted to do it? Do you ever do it?
So Signatera is commercially available in the adjuvant setting in bladder cancer. We do that testing in the clinic. I would say my major fear is that we put the cart before the horse in terms of not having established trials demonstrating clinical utility and knowing really how to most effectively use this information. So it's there. We incorporate it into our data package in terms of thinking about how to best care for patients, but we need to finish these phase three studies.
I mean, absolutely, but it's so hard to ignore, you know. But the other thing is, any thoughts about what the lag time is? How much time you pick up by using this assay in the adjuvant setting?
So the data suggests about 3 to 6 months.
It doesn't really seem like that long.
It doesn't, and it's probably a couple scans. Whether or not MRD based on ctDNA is a intervenable clinical disease state to eradicate disease, I think that remains to be seen. If it is, then that time might be sufficient.
Okay, let's go to your last slide, sort of summarizing things.
So targeting aberrant signaling downstream of HER2 has not been that successful an approach in urothelial cancer for reasons that aren't entirely clear, although you astutely brought up that there are some strategies that have shown some benefit, including dual antibody targeting. So I don't think the story's completely written there, but certainly using HER2 as a target for selective delivery of cytotoxics has been a much, much more encouraging strategy and really validates HER2 as a target in urothelial cancer. We have a bunch of practical and scientific questions, though, that we need to try and answer over the next few years. And one of which is, should we harmonize HER2 assay scoring in urothelial cancer? Do we need a, a urothelial cancer scoring, like we have a breast cancer scoring and a gastric cancer scoring. Are enfortumab vedotin and disitamab vedotin different targets but the same payloads? Are those cross-resistant drugs? We need to determine that. Should we combine HER2 ADCs with PD-1 or PD-1 blockade? Well, I showed you some data that's encouraging, and it's being tested actually in a large phase 3 international study. Should we use HER2 ADCs solely in patients with T+ or 3+ expression? And ultimately, as you brought up, what's the role of these drugs in first-line treatment when we've just had a major shift in first-line treatment of urothelial cancer? And I think there's trials that are designed to answer many of these questions here. So I don't think we'll have to guess in a couple of years.
So just to finish out on an old story there, because I was just flashing back on this trastuzumab, pertuzumab thing, as I was remembering, we actually had a case, a patient who had a great response for like 6 months. I never heard about that in breast cancer. I was asking Ian Kropp, I don't know if you know him from Yale, one of the big HER2 people in breast cancer, like, why do I hear about these responses as trastuzumab, pertuzumab outside of breast and not in breast? And he goes, well, by the time they get to metastatic disease, they've already had so much anti-HER therapy. But he reminded me that if you look back at the naive patients, they did respond to trastuzumab, pertuzumab. It's just that you had better if you added chemo. So I guess my question is, if you can't access the ADC, or maybe they've already, you know, in the future, they've already had an ADC, would it be worth trying trastuzumab, pertuzumab if they had no other options afterwards?
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable strategy in that setting. And this is pure speculation, but based on some of the data that you're bringing up and maybe a little bit of anecdote, my sense is that maybe it's the patients with amplifications that might respond more to a strategy like that than patients with just HER2 overexpression at the protein level. And so what one would probably want to be confident that amplification is still present. But yes, I think that's a reasonable strategy in that setting.
I do want to bring up one other thing. I think you sort of alluded to it, but I just wanted to ask again. I hear about this. One of the things that's interesting that I hear a lot about, particularly in GI cancers, but just clinically, the general medical oncologists, to see the GI people doing one thing, breast people, lung, et cetera, it's sometimes a little bit confusing in terms of this. But particularly the GI people, I hear a lot about them. They identify the patient as HER2 positive, but they keep looking for HER2, particularly in liquid biopsies. And then if they don't see it, if it goes away, they stop using HER2 therapy. Whereas the breast people, once you're HER2 positive, you're always HER2 positive. So what side are you on?
So I think that particularly because we have multiple HER2 ADCs with different payloads, I think we need that data to be able to manage patients in the future. We need that data. Is the protein being lost? And that's why resistance develops. That's not only important from a scientific standpoint, but that is going to help guide what you do for that patient next. So we have none of that data in urothelial cancer in terms of serial lines of anti-HER2 therapy and serial testing in biopsies.
Subsequent to this recording, on April 5th, 2024, the U.S. FDA, for the first time, approved a therapy, TDXD, that is now the first HER2-directed therapy to receive a tumor-agnostic approval in patients with previously treated advanced HER2-positive solid tumors.